Hello and welcome to the Broadcast Tech Talks podcast. My name is Jake Bickerton and I'm the Editorial Director of Broadcast Tech. The Broadcast Tech Talks podcast shines a light on creative uses of technology in the broadcast industry. On today's Broadcast Tech Talks podcast is the full recording of the opening session discussion at the recent Future of Post-Production Forum in association with Avid at BFI South Bank London.
This is the first session, Evolving Landscapes, the Future of Post-Production in Film and TV. And we'll be talking through a lot of the things that Tom just talked about there. So emerging tech, the evolving creative processes, impact of things like AI, and also the talent challenges that Tom talked about. So before we start, I'm Jake Bickerton. I'm the Editorial Director of Broadcast Tech, and I'd like our panellists to introduce themselves. So Cara, I'll start off with you.
I'm Cara Shepherd. I'm the president of Picture Shop, which is part of Streamland Media.
I'm Adam Downey. I'm Director of Post-Production at Sky.
I'm Claff. No surname required, obviously. Co-founder of Raccoon and now Tanuki.
Excellent stuff. Right. I mean, obviously, I've got a lot of questions that I'm going to go through. But as Tom mentioned, we've got Slido. I have my phone. So if you could, whenever you want, ask a question through Slido with Future of Post is the where you put in for the hashtag. I'll be looking out for the questions as we're chatting, and I can put any questions to our panelists as and when they come in. But we're going to kick off with quite a big question, which Cara, maybe you could start us off with, which is looking at post-production this year. It's obviously got a bounce back from the strikes from last year and the commissioning slowdown from last year, which was international slowdown as well. It's early days, just at the end of January, but Cara, what's the year ahead looking like for you?
I think it's tough. I think unlike coming out of COVID where it was, the doors just burst open and everything went into production and everyone was fighting over staff and, then it ends up you overpaying people and it gets into a whole world of pain, which was obviously very fruitful for many people. But I think then the interruption, our entire industry is like a bit of a juggernaut and the strikes were hugely impactful, double strike. And I think now we're, especially with a lot of commissions coming out of the US, you've had Disney push their entire slate to 2025. Paramount are pretty much doing the same. And I think there's the potential IATSE strike, which their deal is up at the end of July. And I think, globally, not just in the US, I think that will potentially have a huge impact. And talking to a lot of the studios that I have been speaking to, both for TV and for features, is they're holding back commissioning some content. Because what they don't want to do is put a load of things into production, which they have pretty much ready. They have a lot of writers' rooms running. But they're not putting anything into production because they don't want to be held over a barrel in case IATSE do strike. So there's this resistance to actually, a huge glut of commissioning globally, I think, because of that fear at the moment.
So we're already seeing that slowdown as a result of a potential strike.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's we have the ability to do a huge amount of dailies globally, probably about anywhere between 120 to 150 productions at any one time.
Right.
And in November, we globally had 4 productions.
Wow.
In. And normally by this time, we'd be looking at getting up to 100, 120 by April, May, June. And we're probably looking at 60 right now.
Wow. So you're about 50% of what you could be doing.
Yeah.
So how do you, how do you survive that kind of challenge?
It's tough. It's really tough. It's I think everyone in the industry and networks, broadcasters, facilities, I think this is certainly in my career the worst time I've ever seen in the industry. And I don't think that's all bad. I think it's a time for potentially a reset. But I think everyone's budgets are struggling. Everyone's been pushed. And I think, unfortunately, obviously the last week in the UK, we've seen a number of companies go into administration. Mm. And it's really pretty tough times for everybody globally, I think.
Right. It doesn't seem as though there's an obvious, a lot of work potentially coming later in the year that you could say, okay, a bit like
I think we're seeing Q3, Q4 being packed to the point I'm not entirely sure we're going to be able to do it all.
Okay, that's interesting.
Hopefully there's no clients in the room. No, it'll be fine. But it's hugely, you know, it's hugely kind of back-ended, which is obviously really tricky in terms of budgeting and all those kind of things when you have such a, you know, back-loaded end of the year. But I think, you know, we've had to look at diversifying into the types of content we do. You know, we're doing a lot of commercials, especially in the US now.
Oh, yeah.
The Super Bowl's been great for us, thank God. And things like the Sphere project in Vegas, which we did as well. I think, you know, we're having to diversify because, you know, we are such a big business that I think, you know, like I said, the industry is so big that it was quite a juggernaut. When everything stops, it takes such a long time for everything to get up and running, and there's still that resistance to letting things roll because of potentially more strikes.
So later in the year, when all this work comes in, will you still be able to do all of the new work that you're diversifying?
Yes, it's definitely a challenge trying to figure out how we do all of that and looking at capacity and things. And obviously things like we've got CapEx constraints because we've got reduced revenue in the first half of the year. Mm. So, you know, it's not an easy balance to try and strike. Mm. But it's, you know, I'm feeling hopeful towards the end of the year, and obviously it does depend on the strike, which will be massively impactful. And I think, you know, the tough times are not quite over yet, because I think everyone thought strikes would be over, great, yay, we're all back to work. And I think it's been so impactful that everyone's sort of slightly rabbit in the headlights at the moment, waiting for it to get back to normal.
Adam, how's it been at Sky?
Sky's slightly insulated from some of this, as slightly even what Cara said as well. We have a mass portfolio and a diversity that allows, you know, sport has continued throughout this time, those kind of things. But in answer to your question, I kind of like to remove my Sky head and say what it's like, you know, for the post-production, because it has been an absolute perfect storm. You know, the writer's strike affecting scripted, a cost of living affecting advertising, which affects programming that is sponsored by advertising. So I think as an entire industry, it's an industry that's massively suffered. And look, you know, the writer's strike is ending, so there's, yeah, it was ended, so there's some positivity from some of it, but the cost of living is still here, and it's going to keep going for a while. The BBC obviously has been, you know, is struggling with, you know, not having its 9%, you know, and where it's going to find. So in every element of the UK post industry, you know, it's been here. And I think we're looking at a slow return. I agree with what you said. It's not the crashing out of the, you know, the end of COVID was... Yeah. It was, you know, it was unbelievable. It was really difficult to cope with it. And we're looking at a much more slow and staggered return to normality over the end, towards the end of the year, I think.
Because there was that traffic jam, wasn't there, after the pandemic?
And, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people were predicting the same now, weren't they?
Yeah, and funny enough, we talk about something that I think we're going to talk about later. It was the amount of people that we lost in our industry during that time, and then the fighting for talent that went on. Yeah, yeah. You know, so it was just... Yeah, it's a very different scenario, I think, that we've got a lot more lead time to build up to that, a lot more time to be prepared for it. Mm. Yeah, but yeah, it's going to take a long time to return back to normal, I think, this year.
Okay, thanks, Adam. And Clough, how about you?
I find myself feeling slightly sick listening to Cara. Oh. I mean, having been there and seen it happen, it always happened. There was always this huge glut where things just moved and you ended up with a big machine that actually was empty, or at 25%, it costs exactly the same to run a big machine at 25% as it does to run it at 100%. So therefore you can't, so making that math work, but thankfully, myself and my fellow founder started another business that actually is able to weather storms like that because we kept our physical costs down. It doesn't mean that there's not been this kind of strange time as far as commissioning goes, but we set up a business entirely to have some technology that allowed for some of that flexibility to keep some of that physical real costs down. But to everybody's point here, it's not over. This was always going to happen. The streamers needed a massive amount of content. COVID was a convenience. COVID wasn't the convenience. The strike was, I believe, a convenience to actually change the way they commission, change the amount of material that they need to make. And there is now going to be an adjustment, and that adjustment is going to take a time. There will always be gluts, because there'll always be a point where you've just got to work now. How we manage that as an industry is complicated, and I think we need to distribute work in a different way. We need to use a global workforce a little bit better, and some of the tools that we're developing will help that. But, you know, there's the amazing tools that Avid have got, and the amazing things that Adobe and everybody else have got. It's how you access them that's the important thing.
So you don't think there's going to be this flood of content that we were kind of used to when we were through the streamers, like commissioning so much put out there? Right.
Not a chance. Just like, there'll still be lots of quality content, because quality will raise to the top. I think there'll just be less noise. The noise is being supplied by TikTok. You know, that's the noise. And the streaming platforms don't need to do that. They need to do something. They need to make the quality content that people want to watch, or as Cara said earlier, the quality content you want to dual stream. You want to have that on your other screen whilst you stream through Instagram. We're just consuming media in a different way. And this has been going on for the last 5-10 years. It's been happening. We're just at a bit of a point now where it really is becoming real.
Do you think that appetite for quick fix, you know, like content, is gone and is already replaced by TikTok?
It's a different media. The irony is that the people that are making that short form content actually have an aspiration to make the long form stuff that we've always done. So that learning curve for them is going to be really interesting. Yeah. That's why we have to have the tools there that they'll go, oh my word, that's how I manage that much media. That's how I manage to make 8 rather than just 1 5-minute thing. I need to make 6 1-hour things. You know, how do I do that? And that learning, that, you know, and finding the right tools for them and the access to those tools, that's what we're all in the business of doing.
Yeah, we'll come back to that sort of creator community a bit later. Yeah. But if there is this fundamental shift in commissioning and what streaming platforms are looking for, lots of content in the past, now very high quality content but less of it, how do you adapt your business models to cope with that? And do you agree with what Clav's saying?
I think to a certain extent. I think, you know, everyone thought the world of feature films was dead when the streamers came along, and then look at last year, and you've got Oppenheimer and Barbie and Mission Impossible and, you know, Indiana Jones. And while it's not certainly at its peak, I think, you know, there will always be room, I think, for the kind of studio or commission-led high-end productions. I think this is just offering a bigger variation of content than we've ever seen. I don't think it's going to replace it. I think because there'll always be, you know, it's a bit like saying, we'll talk about it in a bit, but AI, you know, is it going to replace everyone's jobs? Well, probably not yet. You know, it might even offer some advantages in the short term. So, but, you know, I think there's a lot of people who have a fear that that's it, this will change for good. And we see that, you know, this happens sort of every 5 years, or something will change the industry dramatically. Right. And then it kind of slowly sinks back to kind of where it was, and just a slightly different variation of it, and just different ways to watch content in different places at any time. And it's just different platforms for people. And it's also making it at a price point much more accessible to anybody and everybody.
Could I just a little bit of, you know, because we were all thinking about this, but people are consuming more and more and more and more content every year, more content, and we go through these fads. I remember ITV saying we're never going to make a drama again, you know. Yeah, we go through these cycles where everything changes, but it will come back, you know. And just to, you know, TikTok, it's just another means of consuming media in a different way. I think there is a place for everything. We think back in the days where BBC, you know, where EastEnders would get 15 million, it now gets 4 million. And that's because there needs to be a lot more content for people to consume, because we don't all consume the same things anymore. So I think it's a true positive that it will come back, and it will be bigger and better and more. And the UK is a place of excellence, I think, is in a real perfect place for when that happens. We're just at this perfect storm, or just coming out of this storm at this minute.
Yeah. And you know, we're driven, technology drives creativity, and creativity then drives technology, but usually you have a technological innovation that allows a new type of creativity. It's all about telling stories, but or presenting entertainment. But there's a technology came along, mobile phones or smartphones, 100% changed people's viewing habits. But there's an awful lot of double screening going on. Mm. So that, and yet, you know, I talk to my kids about television. They have no concept of what television is, but they still watch big screens. Yeah. But they don't. But they watch big screens whilst they're doing something else for about 5 minutes, and then go and do something else. But they, you know, they don't. They'll only ever watch a film in a cinema. They won't watch a film on their own. And then even in the cinema, I'll see if we can get their phones out. So it's not. Yeah. I think it's just. I think it's different. But the content's still there, and there's an aging population who are still spending money, who still want to watch long form content. So the market's all, it's going to be there. And when the kids who were watching stuff on the telephone, they'll get a bit older and they'll want to watch long-form content. So it's not going anywhere. It's just the way in which we go about making it is changing. And but there was a ridiculous rush. There was an arms race for stuff that's calmed down. And there may be another arms race. And I don't think Apple's, you know, their Apple Pro Vision is going to be a revolution. I just think that isn't it. Mm. There will be a technology that will come along that everyone will go, oh, of course. Mm. But I don't know what that is. If I knew, I wouldn't be doing this. there will be a technology change that will cause another arms race for content. Mm. But at the moment, there isn't one. So we're at this kind of steady. We're steadying, and there's, you know, people expanded to fill a glut that was artificial. Mm. And now we need to sort that out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, one thing over the last 12 months that is unavoidable is the growth of AI and generative AI, what that means for, well, everyone and everything. But specifically within post-production, you know, you can look at some of the disciplines like editing, visual effects, sound design, colour grading, you know, all the kind of key things that a post house might offer. You know, if you're looking at it, you could think, well, Gen AI, can't that do all of that? You know, maybe not right now, but maybe in a year, maybe in 2 years' time. It's progressing very quickly. You know, how do you kind of respond to the challenge of Gen AI, specifically in post-production? I'll go to you, Cara, first on that one.
I think it's not a brand new concept to us. I think, you know, we've been using levels of automation at varying degrees for kind of some time, and I think we can certainly see the advantages it will offer. I think it's not going to change everything overnight. I think, like, a bit like, you know, cinema's not going anywhere for the time being. It's a bit like you know, the need to sit down in a room with a colorist or a mixer is not going to go away. It's just going to allow that. It's not going to be you know, kind of those people, the studios, the big budgets and everything else, and that being untouchable and unattainable to everybody. There's going to be much more accessible ways to do things, but that doesn't mean it replaces the kind of high-end stuff. I think it can offer us kind of many advantages, and I think we kind of need to embrace it. I think there's a risk of there's embracing it, and then there's, okay, we need to create... I mean, I have sat, I cannot tell you in how many board meetings with our investors going, we need an AI product. I'm like, what would that be? That's a very big question. And because, you know, people see the money in it and they see the advantages and business advantages. And I think, well, we need to kind of remain open to it. I think there is there's a risk of just running away with kind of some ideas. And it's incredibly, at a very high end, incredibly cost prohibitive. I mean, I think the studios during COVID, for example, we would not be doing as much remote working now if COVID hadn't happened. Mm. Because the studios and the big streamers were probably not quite ready for that level of kind of accessing content remotely. Mm. And I think that's changed the industry for good. But we're now seeing people coming back to the office and everything else. So it, like I said, it kind of slowly goes back into a pattern. But I think it can offer many advantages by removing human error from very simple tasks. You know, you're going to see it in visual effects with a lot of kind of a lower end roto work. So do we see that go to cheaper workforces in India or Asia or wherever else? Or is that done via AI? Mm. And I think you're going to see that. Is it going to replace my very overpriced colorists at tomorrow? No, it's not, because
great value.
Yeah, great value, exactly. But you know what? They are the best in their field. They're incredible artists, and directors continue to want to work with them constantly and pay a very high price to do so. But that's not going to get replaced tomorrow.
Maybe not tomorrow, in 5 years' time?
I don't think so. I think you'll probably see it at a cheaper price point as soon as it becomes, you know, a cost thing. But you're always going to see, you know, the Christopher Nolans of the world are not going anywhere. It will just be replaced by, you know, the next generation. And I think there will always be that need for, be it, you know, we're in the arts. I mean, you know, we're kind of talking at it on a very practical level, but be it music or art or, you know, kind of TV and features or books, it's still driven from a human element. And I think that you're never gonna replace that, not certainly in my lifetime. I think
you made a very, you use the word editor, and one of the problems with generative AI is it doesn't have an edit, and the most important, it generates stuff, and it's, which is useful, but you've got to edit it, because otherwise it just keeps generating stuff. So the key is editor. Now, that term can be used to, it's creative. That is, in the same way as a colorist is sort of an editor. They're editing the colors that you see. You've got this massive gamut. We're going to reduce it down to something that tells the story. Now, AI, creatively, is not going to be able to do that. It's never going to be able to replace what a human does in the edit, in that genuine edit. Because that edit is not, it's not a technical process. Because if it's a technical process, you can automate that. You can do that. Generative AI generates stuff, and we then have to edit it. Brilliant example. My daughter wrote a job application letter using ChatGTP, and it was nonsense. She's an English graduate. She thought it was brilliant. It was just wordy nonsense. And the idea said, use it to start off, but edit it. So it's a great feeder, but it has to be edited. And that's creative. That's what we pay our really good value colorists for, and editors. They're creative.
It seems like it's easy to say that right now, but you know, I
believe it's always going to be. Genuinely believe it. We're in the arts. There will be a huge amount of stuff created that sits here that fills this volume. It's just noise. The quality stuff will keep going. Maybe less. Yeah, no, it may be less, and it might get done in a different way, which is lots of it, and it will suddenly go, well, look, I mean, think about Avid. 20 years ago, I said it's never going to work. Everyone wants to cut linearly, it's like, you know, or 25 years ago, and now it's now the idea of somebody editing linearly is like, what the fuck's that? But sorry, pardon my language. But we will be using AI technologies and generative AI technologies in 5 or 10 years' time, where we'll go, of course, that's the way we do it.
Yeah, but we still call it a bin, and we still call it...
Yeah, oh, yeah, but that just has a legacy terminology.
I'm a true optimist in this. I'm a real believer in this. And if we think of some of the problems that we slightly have talked about, Gen AI have got a real... And by the way, this is my opinion. I'm expressing... I have to say that I'm expressing my opinion, not the opinion of Sky. It's going to make some of our lives and a lot of things that we do simpler. And you know, I agree with the comment. I would call it the pilot logic. Others are using very similar terms. It is going to need a human element across it, because it will speed up what we do. You think of all the slight menial task stuff that we have to get done. Here's where I'm going to play my pessimist and my optimist in the same breath. You know, what happens in our industry when this happens is, sadly, is we immediately look for the cost saving of how we can make it done cheaper. But actually, when we look at some of the problems in our industry, we've got to talk about the next one being about attracting talent and developing talent. And, you know, look, I remember the days whether you get 2,000 CVs for a job, you're not getting anywhere near that now. Our industry is not as attractive as it was. 10-hour days, struggling over 5 days a week, it's not this giant luxury that it was. So eventually it will sort itself out, and hopefully we can get to a place where our industry becomes a bit better at balancing life and work in a much more constructive way for moving forward. So look, it is going to change certain things. There's no doubt about it. It is going to disrupt our industry, but I honestly believe it's going to be in a truly positive way eventually. It will go through a few iterations, you know, a few give me something. And I love Claff's comment about a lot of words, because you know, there's a lot of people made a career out of just a lot of words on a on a page. You know, it will speed up the process of what we're doing. Kara said about, you know, automation, machine. We've looked at these things and we've worked at these for ages, and it's got that next leap of speeding up. The speed that it's going is incredible. Mm. It's absolutely incredible. But that's a good thing, because again, it will just aid us. You know, I always said to someone, you know, you might have a computer drive you to work, but you wouldn't let it paint a piece of art on your wall. And there's a great association to that. If AI can drive me to work, honestly, my work life balance significantly improves. You know, it's like hybrid now being driven to work.
You made an interesting comment about it's cheaper. Is AI going to make it cheaper to make more volume? Does Christopher Nolan ever say, "I need it to be done cheaper"? There's horses for courses, you know. And
I agree.
It will save time, only hopefully to save time in order to do something more creative. Mm. Then, you know, how do you then learn the process if you haven't actually already done it? You know, the thought of, Amit had this, I mean, I don't know if they're still working on it, I'm sure they are, the idea of a co-pilot that sits with you. Mm. It's brilliant when you've forgotten how to do something. If something just says you do it this way. Mm. But the key to that comment is forgotten. You still have to have learnt it in the first place. So you still have to know what you want to achieve in order for AI to help you. Mm. And I think that's different from generative. That's just AI. The ultimate help is where it predicts that you're gonna need to know that, rather than the safety pin in the corner back in Microsoft days.
But think, as an editor, you're sitting there, you need a shot and you don't know where it is. Oh God, what was it? It was on day five at this time code. You just type in, this person sitting at a desk, instantly it's available to you. The way that that's going to speed up our, you know, our lives is truly incredible. You're right. I don't think it's going to change. The artist is still going to be an artist, you know. Hopefully, I really hope that it can affect the work-life balance in our industry, because it is a problem and has been.
Cutting together sports highlights packages, goal packages, all that kind of stuff. You know, there's so much content, there's so much sports. That's obviously going to happen. That's a world I know you're really into. Mm. There's no question that's going to. But the crafted trailer for something is still going to be crafted, because that. You know, AI might get you all the shots together, but you've still got to trim it. In the UK, there's only 25 decisions to make a second, so there's only a certain point where you can cut it. But, you know, so an AI could give it, right, here's every possible combination, pick one. But that's almost where we're at now, you know, so...
Right,
well, it's bright. The future's good. It's genuinely good. These are really, really good things. Like, it's nothing to be frightened about.
It's nice to talk about AI, and actually it feels... Like a lot less of a threat than it does with other conversations, which is good. But we will have to move on from AI. We will hear more about AI later with Avid's roadmap for AI. But we talked about TikTok earlier. Kind of creator generation is clearly making lots and lots of content very quickly. Doesn't need post houses at all. Do you think, given that, you know, that's potentially part of the future way that people are going to, you know, engage with content all the time, why is there no relationship as yet between traditional post and this creator generation? Do you feel like you're missing out or missing a trick, or is there a way of getting these guys to use...
We can't pay them as much as they earn, probably. maybe there's an element of that. I think a lot of these people, they act, as I said earlier, some of them, want to make longer form content. They'd love to. That's what they've always wanted to do. And it's that learning curve from the transition from that to making long form, what does that mean? What is the difference between? And there is longer form content on TikTok, and there's some of the stuff on YouTube's astounding. Mm. You know, and there's proper really quality stuff. They don't mess around. They don't make it. And so, it's just it's different. It's different. You know, and there will be some cross pollination between them. They're different mediums.
Do you work at all, Kara, with any influencers and content creators on social platforms?
Not particularly. No. I think just purely it's probably a price point thing.
Yeah.
I think it's great, and I think it opens up our industry personally to many more people that would have ordinarily been excluded, either from an access point of view or a skill set point of view. And I think making products that are accessible to everybody, I think, is only good for our industry because it will make it grow. We've got more devices to watch content on, more things that we want to watch, a different variation of content. Mm. And I think that's great. But like I said, I think you will always still have, you know, to our point, the Christopher Nolans of the world. But it just might be somebody who started out on TikTok. It's a bit like, you know, how you had directors that started doing commercials and now they're big Hollywood directors. Mm. I think it's just, it will always lead to different points of it. But it's, I think to a certain extent, its price point. If somebody was, you know, wanting to pay, in the US, for example, over $1,000 an hour for a grade, yeah, sure, welcome, do come in. But it becomes the point that running a facility with big physical facilities that are connected globally to other facilities with the best talent in the world is hugely expensive, like hugely expensive. And it's like a car factory. Whether it makes 10 cars or whether it makes 1,000 cars, you can't take out the people that make the windscreen and put the tires on. And, you know, it's a very high fixed cost industry that we have. But I think it will just add to the variation of content, give access to many more people that ordinarily, like I said, would never have had access to our industry. Mm. And I think that's only going to help, you know, diversity in our industry as well, and also the different types of content that we see.
Is there a model of setting up a kind of a separate facility to target that type of content creator?
I think there's different types of things that you're able to offer, whether it has to be a facility for lower budget stuff. I think, to be honest, that's never going to be appealing because people are never going to want... They want the access to the Hollywood experience. You know, they're not going to want to go, but you can kind of have it if it's owned by the same company, but it's the cheaper version. People aren't necessarily going to want that, but I think there are services that you can offer, remote work, bringing up with, you know, sort of talent that are just starting out their career. Mm. It makes it again more accessible. Mm. I think there are certain things that we're able to offer and package to people at a lower price point. But primarily, our business model is based on a lot of the, be it unscripted, be it scripted, be it Hollywood features or commercials now. You know, we operate at a very different price point, and that's not wrong. I think the last thing I want to do is become a jack of all trades and master of none.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're just designed a little bit differently.
Mm. I think collectively, a lot of people in this room, you know, We've built places that people want to work or come to work. Mm-hmm. That's what you build physical. I built physical places that people wanted to work. Farm, even Raccoon now, we've got a physical place. You know, Halo, brilliant, brilliant businesses that people want to come and work. I saw the problem and we've developed a thing that is equally somewhere where people want to come and work, but it virtualizes some of that. So it's how you access all these amazing tools, and that's going to be where the digital first people will go, because they've got the concept of the Hollywood experience, but they've actually understand that they now need to make some longer form content, but this is how they're going to access it. Mm. And if they need a physical room to come and work in, they'll have a physical room, but there's a pathway to all these brilliant tools without having to have 1,000 passwords, without having to have all millions of licenses. You actually simplify it down to a single login with an access to this community where you can find the tools and the tool sets and actually find the work that you need to do as well. So I think that's where we've taken it, and I really believe that's what we've spent all this money developing, but that's how we get that next gen or these different content creators, how we get them into our industry by giving them access to the tools in a different way, not the way historic way.
I see it slightly differently. When you think of what Jake Paul has done for boxing, that these are, you know, yeah. When you think of these are things that now are spinning around production and content, you know, and actually what they're doing is elevating it. They're making it more sellable, more, you know. Think of Barbie and how much the social media impact drives audience, drives survive. You know, grows audience. So I think we think of it. I think we should stop thinking of it as post production in that sense. And it's a branch of production. It's where that. Yeah, I'm not talking about the guy I forget that makes billions of pounds from his YouTube channel. But you know, a lot of it is centered around traditional the beast. The traditional media, and it's an add-on to it. You know, if you said people consume like second screen, a lot of it is that. You know, it is that thing. Well, I'm watching that, but I want to watch all these other opinions of what I'm watching. You know,
and Mr. Beast was the first to do the real life Squid Game as well, wasn't he? You know, way before it became
exactly
an astounding phenomenon. But also, we know nothing about it because we're over 40. You know,
exactly.
Sadly, my kids have made me watch Mr. Beast way too often. But but again, I think it's, you know, Mr. Beast is a different thing, which is about product placement and selling, you know, but it's the same thing. Whether you center it around products or you center it around content, it's an add-on to what we do rather than think of it as a alternative or a competition. I don't see it like that. Yeah.
But a lot of the tools, a lot of the tools that they use, they're the same.
Yeah.
How they use them is different. How they access them is different.
But it drives up content, you know, and therefore what we do at a premium becomes more valuable. You know, if you think of, how much boxing with Jake Paul? Well, it's made put more money into boxing.
Oh yeah,
you know, I think it's a positive thing.
Yeah. We've got lots of questions, so I've got a few more of my own, but I'm going to do these first. Right, I conveniently forgot to bring my glasses, so if I hold it there.
Remind.
Maybe.
Well, what are you? They're just a one and a bit. They'll work for you.
Yeah, do actually.
Really suit you as well. Oh, look a lot wiser.
It's not difficult.
Yeah.
Right, I'm just going to do these in order. This one's had five thumbs up. With some high-profile ransomware attacks on post houses, how are the panel approaching content security in 2024? Right, Cara, this would be a good one for you, international concern, yeah.
So that's something I have first-hand experience of. So it happened to us just before Christmas, and I didn't go to bed for 3 days. That was very exciting. Oh. It's terrifying. It was the same people that came after the Sony Interactive as well. They took down a post house in New York and various other facilities that I won't name, but they tried, and we get people trying to get in multiple times every single day, and we had an experience. Thankfully, they didn't get anything. It was absolutely fine. We pulled the plug on everything, and we had cybersecurity experts come in and sort everything out. They never touched any content. It was absolutely fine, but it was terrifying to the point of. There was some text files that were left. Thankfully, we've got a separate production and a corporate network. They got into a small portion of our corp network. Didn't exfiltrate anything, but managed to get in there to the point. There was some high-level files that were encrypted, and they'd left a text file, which was basically a ransom note. Wow. And there was definitely a moment when my blood ran cold when someone said to me, I was on a Teams call and somebody just wrote ransomware and literally held it up, and I immediately cut the call, and we pulled the plug on hundreds of thousands of machines globally. Wow. And it's taken us up to this point to get everything completely back online. We had no service interruption, we didn't miss any deliveries, and they never accessed any content. But we currently have, I think, Disney re-auditing every facility globally that we have right now, which is really exciting. It proves that, and we have a huge amount of security and many, many levels, and we pay a significant amount for the best security and security content teams and everything to make sure we are, you know, tier zero compliant with most things. And to the fact that they can still get in, you know, we constantly now just have to adapt and change and move. And the moment you kind of go, right, that's it, it's locked up, is the moment someone will find a way around it.
Someone very wisely said to me the other day, maybe one day they'll stop trying to attack us because they'll realise they haven't got any money to pay the rent. They'll realise there isn't the cash that they thought, and they'll go after the TikTokers.
Yes.
That's true. Sounds like they were pretty close with yours, so.
Yeah, I mean, they got to a certain point that they got within our, like I said, in our corporate network with a load of things that were just... It didn't hold any value. Mm. But and thankfully, like I said, we have our networks for security reasons kept completely separately, which is great. But there was that moment that you don't know, you know, when you pull the plug on everything to the point that we had to scan every single machine, every single volume of storage globally. That was a lot. And our poor engineers worked themselves to death. Praise the Lord, they were amazing. But it was, there was a moment where you just don't know how bad it is, and you don't know at what level, and it takes a fair amount of investigation to figure out that actually, thankfully, they got nothing. But there wasn't something that we were missing that we're doing now differently. We're changing many different things, and we have many different protocols. But, you know, we there's a reason that we have, you know, DR recovery plans and things like that. So we have protocols and procedures. And as soon as we got wind of anything, we did that, which was literally cut everything off. And we're fine, but
that's a good, you know, test of your security. I
it is, yes. Everyone kept everyone on their toes, definitely the week before Christmas. But but I think it's, you know, and we have a huge, we've spent a huge amount of money and a huge amount of people protecting what we have, and the fact that they still managed to in some way penetrate the outside was tricky. But so, you know, some smaller houses, it's also quite scary.
I think the key is diligence. You know, there's so much security goes into place. You do everything you possibly need to do, but it comes down to diligence. It's somebody going, I don't think that's right.
Yeah.
And it's having the people who aren't embarrassed to call it out. You know, and seeing, it's like seeing some litter in a hallway. You know, it's like, oh, that's always been there. I actually picked the litter up, and why is that fucking litter there? And I think that is data security. It's like because they'll get in because there's always a way in, no matter what you do, unless there's an air gap, there is always a way in, and there will be, and it's a password that somebody shared, or someone's come in the wrong way, or they've left it in a particular way. It's very, very clever. It's horrible. I don't understand what, it's a whole industry that's doing this, and as I say, I think there's better financial targets than our industry.
I'd say we're locked up like Fort Knox, and it's really difficult.
So are
actually.
We, Adam.
Yeah, no, we do want to.
We all are.
But it makes it quite difficult to be adaptive to new technology because, you know, how you put new systems on, you've got to go through a rigorous process of testing. We're owned by Universal. We've gone through a Comcast audit regularly. And it's there, but I think there's also that scalability of security that is required. You know, different content requires different security. If I take, you know, this again, this isn't sky out the door. I used to work with a company that got bought out by Warner Brothers, and actually we found out the best way of affecting piracy was to insert adverts on any of our content on YouTube. You know, each content requires a different level of security that it is applied to, but in answer, it's tough. Trying to do anything is, you know,
it's just an added cost of business where you know your rent's going up, your power costs are going up, your staff costs are going up, and you cannot not do that.
Yeah.
But then you think, well, okay, this is a whole amount of thing that we're preventing a cyber attack. You can't afford to insure a bit against it. But if you know full well that if you took out 10 million. The ransom would be 10 million. You know, the ransom would be 10 million. So the insurance is actually the money you spend on preventing it. It's just, I mean, it's counterproductive. It's an awful thing. Probably made worse because of what's going on in the East. And
One of the benefits, though, is production who say, oh, we just want to use this new tool. You've got a great excuse to say, well, actually,
you can't.
Well, the famous one, I don't want to use a password. I don't want to use two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
I think I don't want to use it because it gets in the way. It gets me 2 seconds of login. Sorry, you've just got to.
Yeah, you got it.
And two-factor authentication with a mobile device is actually really effective. Mm. It's a really good way. But it doesn't get over the fact if somebody has gone in and they leave something there and then somebody doesn't go in and go, what's that? What's that? What's that login? You know, and that's that questioning, having that confidence that people call stuff out.
Right. That's a great question to ask, actually. Thanks for that. We've probably got time for one more. We'll keep it on very traditional post, and I'm going by the number of thumbs up. So the traditional online suite is killing the post facilities with historically low returns. It's been happening for years. Can we redesign the process so offline becomes profitable again? That's a good question.
Can I love to ask this? So we kept the price of offline artificially low to keep the price of online artificially high.
Okay. And
there's not any other business in the world that would do that. It just makes no sense. So the number of times I had conversations with various members of my sales team a few years ago where they say, look at the price I'm getting for grading. So but we were selling the whole package. So but look what you're selling everything else for. The bottom line price was always the same. So it didn't matter. And he said, look, I've kept the rates here for this, the premium services. But you're giving all this away. There just isn't. There needs to be a readjustment. And that didn't necessarily happen in the States because they bought in a different way, because they bought their editorial. Is a different team buying it, and it certainly happened with Scripted. That's they go off and buy that. And then the finishing was just how much do you want to pay for that creative? And that creative is that much, so you've got it. And then the service that fits around that, and then the delivery around that. The model in the UK was just different. Now, that has to readjust. I don't know how that works, because it is changing. You just separate. You need to separate them, and it's like this is the real cost, and of course this is the real cost for the process, and this is the real cost for that room, and this is the real cost for that creative. It's just a readjustment. I think Charlotte very always has said to me, that bottom line number is always the same bottom line number. They've only got that much money, if you see what I mean. And it's not a problem if they don't run for, if they don't overrun for 20 months in editorial, when in fact all you've got is that one bit of finishing. Mm. They're making one 90-minuter, and they overrun for 2 years in editorial, you're absolutely buggered, because you've just got that one. And that's the... That's the problem, and it's readjusting that. And this has been going on for 10 years, and it is slowly changing in the UK. Yeah, it is changing.
Yeah, I agree. It is changing. I think there's a couple of little things, though, that are worth highlighting to it, which is if you're an offline editor, you're doing a six-week gig. If you're an online editor of colourist, you've got 1 or 2 days. So it's never going to be an equal footing, because you've got to find enough work to fill and to create a viable income. But I agree, I think it is changing. We've seen in the past, and again, not Sky Hat, but we've seen in the past this logic, I want a locked-in cost of offline and a locked-in cost of media. And you're like, well, no, they're the most variable things you're going to do. So if I do that and agree to that, it just means I make less money out of the... So that leveraging all of our profit in the olden days onto the finishing is slightly moved. It's got to go for that reason. And we've talked slightly on AI, and it is going to make things simpler, but it's also going to therefore probably make things a little bit more difficult. Shooting high ratios when tapeless came in, you know, when we think of audio cleanup tools, does that mean that we get rougher audio? That means more work that comes into it. All of these things are going to, have their impact. But going back to the original question, it's got to change, and it is changing. It will continue to change. But there is a differential between one day of work and 6 weeks
of
work.
The answer, of course, is finishing-only facilities. Finishing-only, just literally, these rooms just are taking it and finishing and mastering and delivery. And the editorial technical process, which needs to be, it's not democratized, it just needs to be another way of doing that. And if they need rooms, they can have rooms that they drop in and out. You just need a single access point to that editorial team.
For Scripted, that's where we're going.
Yeah.
Unscripted, very different. You know, it's very offline heavy. The clients want it as part of a package. Very much so, that's very integral to what we're doing and our offering globally. But in terms of Scripted, especially, I mean, I take the UK, you've got Hireworks, and you've got Vivid, and you've got Pivotal, and various others. And, you know, when I worked for a facility in Soho, the cost of the real estate meant that we had to maintain, and we had the most expensive cutting rooms in town. We had to maintain an 88% occupancy to make it break even at the most expensive rooms in town. Mm. For me, I think when you have such good, you know, unless your business is like the guys I just mentioned, unless your business is Avid and that kind of support and that backbone that you can offer a Scripted production, I think certainly in terms of Scripted specifically, We are certainly offering less offlines, unless we're able to offer the avids as well, which we have a huge amount globally, just purely because, you know, especially on the higher end productions, editors want to use their preferred vendors, or they want to be in a specific place, or they don't want to share storage with somebody else, you know. And I think that's going to be a big culture change. But for us, you know, you've had to, with prices not climbing the way that costs have, and the margins getting squeezed, we've had to look at, you know, varying our business model.
The risk, though, on this, again, it with scripted, it's in a different world, and we cover that plethora. But you know, the offline industry in this country is pretty much already outside. It's freelance. The whole industry is freelance. You know, this idea that we need to move to a place of finishing, that happened, and that's what's driven slightly the cost reduction of offline. You know, as we have concentrated as an industry on selling finishing services and top-ending that. So for me, you've got to look at it as an ecosystem, as the whole of post-production. And I think that actually it's about, it doesn't matter. Look, offline, we know, can be a lot more adapted to hybrid, a lot more adapted to where, you know, and therefore your investment in bricks and mortar becomes easier. But a lot of post houses also made a lot of money from controlling the media. Yeah, that sat behind it. Yeah, so I think we've got to look at it as an entirety rather than think just of finishing, because if we keep putting all our money in finishing, the price of finishing goes up, and that drives down the cost of offline. I think we've got to think of it as a whole ecosystem and offline. You know, meaning,
I think, yeah, defining what which content needs finishing, and the that quality content and how it's finished, and or that. These are conversations we've been having, the same conversation we're having for years. It's just becoming more and more into sharp focus because the cost of real estate, or cost of real estate in places where people can get to, and the power and everything else, has just gone, it's too expensive. Mm. Now, whether there'll be a readjustment when city centres become cheaper, right? It doesn't appear to be happening. Mm. In central London rates are...
I'm going to be literally killed in a minute. I can see death stare. So I'm really sorry we've actually slightly overrun.
Holding up a sign. Yeah. Time.
It's been brilliant. And we could, and we, you know, have enough questions to carry on for at least another hour, but we're going to have to stop there. And we are going to be around in the break. So, you know, do catch up with these guys and have a chat through this. It's fascinating. Say a big thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really good.
Many thanks for listening to today's episode of the Broadcast Tech Talks podcast. Please like and subscribe, and we'll see you on the next one.